We are doing a Bible study tonight on St. Elijah, or St. Elias, however you want to say the name. And he is the patron of our church, of course, and his feast day is next week. And so I thought we would do a study on him tonight. And then next week, the night after his feast, we could do a Bible study on St. Elisha, or Eliseos, or however you want to say his name as well, his partner in crime there. So we'll look at both of these really important characters, not only in the Old Testament, but their typological import for the New Testament as well. So where do we find St. Elias, St. Elijah in the Old Testament? Well, there are a lot of references to him in the Old and the New Testament. You probably know most of them in the New Testament, little quick references here and there, especially regarding John the Baptist or St. James's reference to him in his epistle. But in the Old Testament, the narrative of his life, at least the most detailed version of that, is found toward the end of 1 Kings. So you turn over in your Bibles to the books of Samuel and Kings. The books of Samuel and Kings. And you come to 1 Kings. And 1 Kings chapter 17 is where he comes on the scene. 1 Kings chapter 17. If you have a Douay-Rheims or a Bible that follows the Septuagint numbering system, this would be 3 Kings, but most of you probably don't have that. So if you have only two books of Kings, then you want to turn to 1 Kings. If you have four books of Kings, then you're going to want to turn to 3 Kings. Hopefully it doesn't confuse half of you. All right, so now 1 Kings chapter 17. This is the first reference to him. Lots of other references after that, but this is the narrative that most people know at least somewhat about in regard to the life of St. Elijah. St. Elijah, chapter 17, 1 Kings. Elijah. So Elijah, the name here, Elijah, El, the name El is a short form of Elohim. Elohim is the normal form of the word for God in the Old Testament Hebrew. So if you see the word God in your Old Testament, if you go and look in the Hebrew, the word there is Elohim, typically, 99% of the time. The rest of the times, very brief other occurrences, you're going to get the word Elo or El, the shortest form. They're all the same word in a certain sense. There's longer and shorter versions. We could get into Hebrew grammar here, but we don't have time to do that. So this is, by the way, if you're interested, this is the same word as Allah. Allah. Okay. So you might say, Allah, you mean the God of the Muslims? Okay, no. Allah, Elo, Allah. This is the Semitic word for the one above you, the thing above you. Okay, this is a Semitic root for that. So the one up, you know, you could understand why the Semites talked about, use this word to describe God, the one above. Okay, so the word Elohim or Elo, the shorter form, the singular form, and then El, the very short form is what you get here, which is typically what you get in names. Think of Ezekiel, right? Ezekiel. Or Gabriel, Michael, right? So that L, that's that name, God, right? So Gabriel, mighty one of God, Raphael, medicine of God or healer of God, Michael, he was like God, Ezekiel, hardened by God. So here, El, God. And then you have Yah is the personal name of the God of Israel, right? So he revealed himself as Yahweh or Yahweh, however you want to pronounce the name. We can't get into those details tonight either. So El Yah, Yahweh is God, or God is Yahweh. That's basically what his name means. God is Yahweh. Yahweh is God. Now, why does he have that name? Well, that's his mission. The prophets always, their name reveals their mission. His purpose is to reveal to the people of God, the people of Israel, that Yahweh, the God of Abraham, is the only true God. At a time when the people of Israel were highly confused, as the people of Israel are today regarding Pachamama and other things. Okay, so now Elijah the Tishbite of Tibet in Gilead said to Ahab, so who's Ahab? Ahab's the god of the king of the northern kingdom. Okay, so remember Israel had two kingdoms at this point. They split north-south, Samaria in the north, Judea in the south. So in the north, Samaria or Israel, however you want to call that northern kingdom, the king is Ahab. As Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there should be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word. Right? So what is he doing there? He's standing before Ahab, who is a polytheistic king of Israel, and making a wager here, a challenge. There's only one God. That's my name. Yahweh is God. And by my word, the one prophet of that God will determine whether there is water or not falling on your land. Now, this may not seem like a big deal to you. If you live in California, you might see it differently. But wherever there's drought or desert or it's an arid land, rain is really important. And in these regions, especially in the ancient world, there is no irrigation water being piped or pumped from wells or something. So it's all rainwater. So they would plant their fields, their barley, their wheat, just before the rain came. They'd plow it, get it all ready. They'd plant all their seed and then wait for it to rain. Now, if it doesn't rain, if there's no irrigation, if there's no water, the seeds don't sprout. So for 3 years, right? 3 years complete in the Bible, 3 years, there's no rain and therefore no food, no barley, no wheat, and there's no Costco. Okay, so, and the word of the Lord came to him, depart from here and turn eastward, depart and hide yourself in the brook of Kereth and there east of the Jordan, and you shall drink. And so we hear about God taking care of him while he is in need, and other stories here with the widow as well. All right, so chapter 18 is we'll pick up here. So chapter 18, and after many days, the word Lord came to Elijah in the third year. So it's been 3 years, no rain, no irrigation. There's no well. There is no barley. There is no wheat. There is no food. Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the land. So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now, the famine was severe in Samaria. Then we hear about another little sub-story about about Ahab trying to find water for the livestock. We can skip that for now. Verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have forsaken the commandments of Yahweh and followed the Baalim." Okay, so I'm giving you the name Yahweh there just to really emphasize the point. In our English translation, sometimes it's not so colorful. Okay, so you have Lord in all caps in almost all Bibles there. Lord. That means that in the Hebrew text, you have the divine name. So if you have Lord, capital L, lowercase O-R-D, that means you have a different Hebrew word, Adonai, which means master, Lord. But whenever in most modern English Bibles you see Lord in all caps, what that means is in the Hebrew text, you actually have the divine name there. We would do very well to put that there. I don't know why they avoid that. But so Lord, Yahweh, Yahweh or Yahweh, however you want to pronounce it. There's a debate among scholars, but we can't get into that tonight. So Yahweh as the God of Israel, and you have followed the Baalim, the false gods of the land. Now, therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So, characters in the story. First of all, the human characters. We know who Elijah is. Ahab is the king of the northern kingdom. Israel, again, has split between the north and south. In the north, Israel or Samaria, whatever you want to call it. In the south, Judea. Judah, the kingdom of Judah. In the north here, both nations are plagued by polytheism, but the north is much worse in that regard at this stage. So Ahab has married a Sidonian princess, Jezebel, and she has brought with her into the kingdom the worship of her pagan gods. And so now the polytheism of the north has just become much more complex. And so the north is the primary worship in the north at this stage is the worship of Baal and Asherah. Baal is in the singular. When you see it there in the singular like that, that's the personal name or title in a certain sense, but it becomes basically like a name for the god of the Canaanites who gave them rain, the rain god of the region. And Asherah is his wife, his goddess wife. So he's challenging Ahab here. He says, hey, let's go have a contest on Mount Carmel. It'll just be me against the 450 prophets of Baal, your favorite god, and Jezebel's favorite goddess, Asherah, the wife of Baal. Bring those prophets too. We'll have a nice little basketball game. Okay, so they're going to go to Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is, I'll draw it on the board here for you, give you a little bit of a sense of it, okay? So if you think of Israel as the Mediterranean Sea, Dead Sea, Jordan River, Sea of Galilee, okay? The Jezreel Valley is right here. A lot of battles happen in the Jezreel Valley as you read the Old Testament. This is the area that we're in right now. This is the Samaria, Jezreel Valley. Samaria is right here, as far as the hill country of Samaria. But this whole area is in the control of Samaria, the hills and then the Jezreel Valley. If you're sitting in the Jezreel Valley and you look toward the Mediterranean, you can't see it because there is a mountain range right there, dividing the Jezreel Valley and Samaria from the Mediterranean is a coastal range. The rain clouds that come from the Mediterranean as they blow off the sea to the region first hit the coastal range. And they dump whatever moisture they have to get over the coastal range. And then they keep going, whatever's left. One of the highest peaks on the coastal range in this spot is Mount Carmel. It's not a mountain by itself, it's a peak. And if you're sitting in the Jezreel Valley and you look west, hoping to see the Mediterranean, you see this big mountain range in front of you. And as you look up, the highest peak blocking you from the Mediterranean is Mount Carmel. The locals believed that Mount Carmel was, because it was the highest peak in that spot, and tended to be green because of its elevation as the clouds come over, the rain dumping on it and fog and stuff like that. It tended to be the greenest of the peaks. The local pagans saw it as the Mount Olympus of Baal. Okay, the mountain where Baal dwelt. And so for Elijah to say something like this is a pretty serious contest. We're going to go up to Mount Olympus, right? We're going to go up to Mount Carmel, the home court of Baal, and there we're going to have a little contest. But it's just me against the rest of them, the other prophets. Okay, so he says, this is verse 20. So Ahab agreed. Look at this. Ahab agreed. Why? Because from Ahab, a stinking pagan's perspective, this is a great opportunity for this politician, this pagan politician, to convince the people of Israel that the God of Israel is no God to be concerned with, but rather the God that he has been interested in and has been convincing the rest of Israel to be interested in, making it their patron God, that's the God they need to worship, that is Baal. And Asherah, his goddess wife, of course, important. So in verse 20, so Ahab, agreeing to this, obviously, sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping with two different opinions? If the Lord, Yahweh, is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I only am left, a prophet of Yahweh. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Okay, so think of a basketball game. Okay, it's one man against 450 other players on the other side. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of Yahweh. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. That is, he is the true God. He is the God to fear. And all the people answered, it is well spoken, right? This is a great contest. So again, you have to put yourself back in their world. These people are dwelling. The people who have gathered at Mount Carmel would be primarily the farmers of the Jezreel Valley. This is the primary population right there at the foot of Mount Carmel. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to redraw this to kind of magnify it for you a bit. So there's the mountain range. Sea of Galilee. Jordan River. This is the Jezreel Valley. And then Mount Carmel would be a peak right there. And we're not talking about a very large piece of geography either, okay? So if you're in the Jezreel Valley, you want to go up the top of Mount Carmel. I've never done the climb myself, but you could probably do it, you know, in a couple of hours if you're really moving. This coastal range is not, don't think of like the Sierra Nevada range, okay? These are just big hills from a California standpoint, okay? It's not too different from the coastal range of California. If any of you have been to California or live in California, the coastal range is kind of like the similar type of mountain range. They're not small hills, but they're certainly not mountain range like the Sierra Nevadas or something. You can climb to the top of any one of the coastal range from the bottom to the top easily within an hour to 2-3 hours max. All right, so they're down the Jezreel Valley. These are the farmers. These are the people who have been affected by this famine. like this drought and therefore this famine. There's no water to water their barley and grain, and wheat. So these people have come up to the mountain and they're standing there listening, and Elijah gives them the rules for the contest. There's only one prophet of Yahweh against 450 prophets of Baal. Now, in the pagan mind, a god answered the prophet when someone got his attention. So they thought, the pagans thought of the gods in extremely anthropomorphic ways. So the gods were sometimes asleep. The gods were sometimes playing games or distracted with something else going on. Sometimes they were dialoguing or talking with each other. And so you had to get the attention of the god. And the way you got the god's attention was by saying his name. And if you were a really, really serious prophet of that god, you might know his secret names. That is his middle names, okay, to use kind of our modern experience. Do you remember when you were a kid and you got in trouble, but you weren't, maybe your mother called you? And first she called out, "Johnny, get over here." And you didn't listen. But then she said, "John Michael, get in the house now." Whoa, she used the full name. You know you're in trouble, okay? So now you know she's calling you and you better answer, okay? So the ancient prophets in these pagan contexts were thought to know not only the god's name, but to know his secret names. So to call on the god's name, and if you had more prophets calling on the name of the god, obviously he's more likely to hear it, right? So you got, again, put yourself in that pagan context in which they would hear this contest that Elijah's giving them. Now, Elijah realizes the foolishness of all this, but they don't. He realizes there's only one true God, and it doesn't matter whether one or multiple gods call upon him or multiple prophets call upon him. And he also knows that Baal is not a god, and so it doesn't matter whether there's one or 450 prophets. It's not going to make any difference. But the people of Israel don't understand this, and that's the point of the contest. Okay, so now he says, and then we're going to put the sacrifice, the bull, on our altars, and then the God that offers by fire, he's the one true God. Now remember, Baal was the rain god. They thought that Baal rode on a cloud. When the clouds came over Mount Carmel, they didn't see it coming over Mount Carmel. They saw it leaving Mount Carmel. All right, so put yourself down in the valley. They see clouds coming from the tip of Mount Carmel. And they think, Baal is coming to give us rain. And when the rain clouds come, we all know that sometimes they come with thunder and lightning too. So they also thought of Baal as not only the god who rode on the clouds and gave them rain when he was happy, but he was also the god who was mad, could send lightning and yell with thunder. So again, you're a pagan in the region. You're waiting for Baal to bring you rain, and you got 450 prophets gathered at his home court. This is an easy contest for Baal. He's the god of lightning. He's the god of rain. He's the god who answers by fire from heaven. You couldn't get any easier of a contest for Baal. 450 prophets, his home court, and it's his game. Okay. All the people answered, "It is well spoken." Great contest. Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first, for you are many, and call on the name of your God, but put no fire to it." And they took the bull, which was given them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped about the altar, which they had made, probably some sort of liturgical dancing of some sort. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry out aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he has gone aside," that means he's using the restroom, "or he is on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened." And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their customs with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And at midday pass, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one heeded. The author here, this guy could get a Nobel Prize of Literature or something like, okay, this is so funny and so intense. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of Yahweh that had been thrown down. So there must have been some sort of an altar there at some stage in which they had offered sacrifice to Yahweh. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And with the stones, he built an altar in the name of Yahweh, and he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 measures of seed. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, "Fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it a second time. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. So why 4? Probably the 4, right? The shape of the altar or something like that, the 4 sides. But then and then 3 times. So complete, right? 3 times they do it. And they did a third time. The water ran about the altar and filled the trench also with water. This is not the way you start a barbecue. Okay? Anyone trying to start a summer barbecue? We just had a barbecue. So when the kids go out there and we put the wood on it, if I told them to pour water on the wood, is it going to work? No. So imagine filling the barbecue with water. Completely insane, right? Anybody who knows anything about starting a fire would know this is not the way you start a fire. And Elijah, of course, knows that. He wants to make sure that the prophets of Baal and the people of Israel all see and know that this is not the hand of man. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, so the people have been there all day long. There's some chronological markers here. It says, at verse 29, look at this, verse 20. And at midday, as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. So there's your chronological marker. So they've been doing this all morning. They have been praying and dancing from sunrise until midday. And then at midday is when he starts mocking them. But then they keep going from midday until evening, the time of the offering of the oblation. This language goes back to Exodus 29:30, the morning and evening offerings. So they have started somewhere around sunrise. The people arrive. You don't climb mountains in this region in the middle of the sun, you know, in the heat of the sun, you're not going to work. So you have to go up early in the morning, but it's still dark, go up to the top of the mountain, and they've been sitting there, eating their breakfast, waiting. And the sacrifice, or this attempted sacrifice, starts by the prophets of Baal all morning until noon. Nothing happens. Elijah starts mocking them from lunchtime until evening. Nothing happens. Imagine being there, sitting there as an Israelite, watching this, watching your prophets that you thought were the prophets of the true gods failing to bring down the fire. And then it says, at the time of the oblation, so this is now evening time. the sun is about to set. It's cooling down. The breeze is coming from the Mediterranean, and the sun, and now Elijah begins. Verse 36. At that time, at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Answer me, O Yahweh, answer me, that this people may know that thou, O Yahweh, art God, and that thou hast turned their hearts back, right? That he's bringing them back to him. Then fire of the Lord, fire of Yahweh, fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, right? They bowed down with their heads to the ground. Right? And they said, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. This is actually Elijah's name. The long form, Elijah, if you look in the Hebrew text, the normal form of his name is actually Eliyahu. So El, God, Yahweh, who, he. So Eliyahu. Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. That's his name. This is the name of this prophet. And so this is what they actually proclaim. Eliyahu, Eliyahu, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. And Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Let not one of them escape. And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon and killed them there. And Elijah said to Ahab, go up and eat and drink, for there is a sound of the rushing of rain. So Ahab went up to eat and drink. So they have a feast there. And Elijah went up to the top of Carmel, and he bowed himself down upon the earth and put his face between his knees. This is the prostration, right? They go down on their knees and they put their head to the ground. So his face between his knees. Sounds funny in English, but this is the Semitic way of bowing down to the ground. And he said to his servant, go up now, look toward the sea. And he went and looked. So Matt, they're on the coastal range. They're looking out toward the Mediterranean, right? So look toward the sea, probably a nice view up there. And he said, there is nothing. And he said, go again seven times. And at the seventh time, he said, behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising out of the sea. And he said, go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down lest the rain stop you. And in a little while, the heavens grew black and the clouds and wind, and there was great rain. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel, and the valley down below. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded himself his loins and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. Outran the chariot. The guy could really move. Okay, so that's how the prophets, the leaders of God's people in the Old Testament dealt with pagan worship. That's also how they dealt with those religious leaders in the region of the kingdom of God who misled the people into pagan worship. Certainly some lessons there for our day. Chapter 19, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. So look at this rain comes flooding upon the land. Why? Why is the rain coming now? Because the land needs rain. For 3 years it has had no rain. But the people have now returned to Yahweh. They've now returned to worship the one true God. And so now he fulfills his promise to them that if you continue to worship me and me alone, then I will provide for you the things you need. Now, why does he want to be worshiped? Well, Yahweh doesn't change. God is immutable. But he's also a loving father and immutable. So he always is a loving father, and he wants what is good for his children. He has made humanity in his image and likeness. And if in humanity is made in his image and likeness, it is to grow in his image and likeness. And we are, you've heard it probably said before, we are religious beings by nature. We yearn for relationship. And that with which we are in communion or relationship with is that we grow into. A man and a woman, when they start to date or get married, start to talk like each other, start to act more and more like each other. You may, as parents, remember maybe one of your kids coming back from school one day and talking a little funny, acting a little differently. What do you know enough? You say, ah, you have a new friend at school? Who are you hanging out with now? Something's funny. You're talking different. Okay, so what's going on there? You know enough to know that your child is starting to imitate or act like in some way somebody else at school that they weren't around before. It is part of our human nature. We are religious by our nature. We yearn for relationship, and then we grow in that image and likeness of that relationship of the individual with which we're in communion. God has created us for this. This is important. He made us so that we could grow, so we could change, so we could develop, so that for all eternity, we could grow in perfection into the image and likeness of He who is perfect. What an incredible gift of glory. But if we are in communion with, if we're in relationship with, if we're in dialogue with, if we're meditating upon something that is not God, something that is not in the image and likeness of God, something that takes us away from Him, then we grow in the image and likeness of something else. We grow in a deformed manner, like a plant that is growing or a tree growing in a deformed way. And who wants that to happen, any plant or tree, and much less a father for his children? And so why does God want us to worship him, that is, be in communion with him, to focus on him, to learn from him, to imitate him? Because he wants us to grow in the image and likeness of that for which we were created. He wants us to grow properly and in a healthy manner to come to our fulfillment, our fruition, our joy, rather than to grow in a deformed and manner in which we will find no happiness. It's very simple. Very simple. And so Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Well, Jezebel wasn't very happy about that, so she decided she was going to kill him. Elijah then fled. I love this story. So it says, verse 3, then he was afraid and he rose and went for his life and came to Beersheba. So he was way up in the north. And now he goes all the way to Beersheba. Beersheba is way down the south, the southern tip of Judea, which belongs to Judah, and left his servants there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, that is the Negev, down the south, and came and sat there under a broom tree, the scrub tree out in the desert there, and he asked that he might die. Right? Can you imagine? That's a long journey. How long would it take to get there? That's at least a day, couple days journey, maybe 2-3 days journey. I don't know. And he's fleeing for his life. And he gets to a point where he just says, God, kill me now, please. It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I am no better than my father's. And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, arise, eat. He looked, and behold, there was his head a cake baked on hot stones in a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, else the journey will be too great for you. And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, Sinai, the Mount of God. Right, all the way from way up in Samaria, all the way down to Mount Sinai, way down the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula, right where it all began, where God had revealed himself to Israel. And there he came to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very jealous for Yahweh, the God of armies. For the people of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thy altars, slain thy prophets in the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go forth and stand upon the mount before Yahweh." And behold, Yahweh passed by, and a great strong wind rent the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, on an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very jealous for Yahweh, the God of armies. The people of Israel have forsaken thy covenants, thrown down thy altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And Yahweh said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus." What? I just came from there, right? So go back to the place from which you came. Head back to the north. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And him who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay. And him who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. And so he departed. There's some great messages in there, of course. We probably all know that story well. But so here's Elijah fleeing from Jezebel after he just did this, after this great miracle he witnessed and the people of Israel witnessed on Mount Carmel. He flees from there in fear, understandably, I guess. He flees all the way down to Mount Sinai, and there God speaks to him in a whispering voice. Elijah thinks he's the only one left of all of Israel who worships Yahweh. And yet we hear there are 7,000 who still worship the one true God. 7,000, the number of covenant, right? So there are still 7,000 who keep the covenant to worship the one true God. And not only that, he's told he's going to anoint the king for Syria. He's going to anoint a new king for the north who will replace Ahab. And he's going to anoint a prophet to replace himself. That is, the faith is going to continue. In fact, we don't have time to read it, but Jehu is quite an interesting character. The next king in the north, what does he do? When he takes over after killing Ahab, he calls for a beautiful worship service in Samaria, in the capital city, of Baal. He says, "All Baal worshipers, please come to the city for a major festival of Baal." And when they'd all gathered in the temple of Baal, he told his soldiers to go and slay every one of them. So there's some great encouragement here for us, I think. And also some marching orders. When things get really bad, and I think many of us know this and experience this in our lives, when things tend to get really bad, that's when we start to get on our knees and start praying, don't we? It's when things start really getting bad, and we get desperate. Maybe I should pray. Then we're reminded to pray. That's one thing. Important lesson there. Two, we also see in the story here that when we think we're the only one left, right? How many times does that happen in our lives? Does anyone else believe? Is it only me? Is it only my particular, you know, family or my particular community or whatever it might be, who are the only ones left who believe? Here's Elijah. Am I the only prophet? And God says, Elijah, there are 7,000 people in Israel who have not worshiped Baal. And then we also get an important message here, is that God is in control and that he will take care of these things. And that when we are at an incredible crisis, as we continue on the story of Elijah and Elisha, as we continue on the story, we find that God begins to bring vengeance upon these wicked individuals, Ahab and the worshippers of Baal, and Jezebel, especially, if you know the rest of the story, what happens to her. And eventually, the northern kingdom is purified of its paganism. Eventually, the northern kingdom becomes monotheist again. And by the time we get to the first century, after great chastisements, the Samaritan people, the people of the north, are worshiping only one true God again. And in fact, they're so pious and zealous about what they're doing that they often shine very brightly in the parables and in the rest of the New Testament. Think of the story of the Good Samaritan. Think of the mass conversion of Samaria with the preaching of Philip the Deacon in Acts chapter 8. All of this is to give us hope, to give us faith, trust in the midst of the situation in which we might find ourselves in any time of crisis. And I think a time of crisis even now, as we find so many worshipers of Baal or Pachamama even among us in the civil authorities and tragically even within the church. Glory be to the Father and to the Son and the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and to age of ages. Amen.